I have a very special guest with me today, a very dear friend. His name is David McBride. He is a former... He went into the British Army. He finished Sandhurst, which is like our equivalent of West Point in the United States. And so he became an officer. And then in the Australian SAS, which is the Special Air Service, so these are special forces, he was a lawyer, and he exposed corruption and war crimes, and they're trying to put him in jail for that. David, it's great to have you on. How are you?
I'm very happy to be back on. Richard, you have a particular place in my heart because you were one of the very first interviews that I did, long interviews with someone overseas. And
thank you.
That was we've played that and replayed that. And since then, you've got bigger and bigger too. So it's great to be back with you.
Thank you. I appreciate that very much, David. And, you know, the thing is that I kind of wanted to start with this recent ruling in Australia. And I thought you know, you're the person to ask, not only because you're a whistleblower, you were in the SAS, but you're also a lawyer, right? So can you just start out very simply by telling us who Ben Robert Smith is? Because I think there's a trend to market him as the most decorated Australian soldier alive, and he was in Afghanistan and he received the Victoria Cross. But for the people who don't know, can you explain who he is and why this recent ruling was so important?
Well, I'm interested to see my friends in the UK. It's had a lot of coverage in the UK, which is interesting. Not much in America. He was Australia's most famous soldier by far. He was the face of the Afghan War. And it is a very important case because a lot flows from this. He won an important medal in 2006. I'll just give people a painted history. Below the Congressional Medal of Honor, but just below. And then 3 years later, he won the equivalent of the Congressional Medal of Honor. He also did a lot of press conferences. He's a huge bloke physically, very good looking. Women just swoon over him. He's like 6 foot, six foot six, like an American football player. Very well muscled, tattooed. But very well spoken, and he gave a lot of press conferences, and he was just generally he was probably the most loved, you know, and he was even Father of the Year, and he would do media appearances with abused women, you know, and put his arm around them in a very paternal way. He was beyond most. So there was no one else like him. You know, if he had stood for president, he would have been elected. Put it that way. And there were always rumors about him in the military, and quite well known. But rumors are just rumors. And in 2018, the newspaper, two very big newspapers, equivalent of the Washington Post, I guess, in Australia, ran these huge stories saying, actually, first they used an assumed name. So it got everybody's interest up. They called him Leonidas. They said, you know, based on the Spartans. And it seems like they didn't choose that name randomly. It seemed like his whole ethos was like he kind of thought he was Leonidas. And mm-hmm. when he kicked someone off a cliff, he seemed to think that he was acting out some scene from 300.
So he literally kicked someone off of a cliff. An Afghan man. That's what the
judge said. Yeah, and it wasn't even. A lot of his defenders say, "Oh, well, you know, he was just taking out Taliban, and that's what happens in war." But that wasn't the case. This was just a random guy who had gone to the local village to buy flour, and been picked out, they'd asked, where are the Taliban? And this guy was like, no, any Taliban. And then they just killed him. And so he wasn't, there was no suspicion that this bloke was Taliban. It looks like most of the things they did, and snippets of, for people who are in the military, you pick up on snippets of the story that go over other people's heads. Now, one of those things that came out that other SAS soldiers, and this was another good thing, he was outed not by journalists, really, when they ran the story, but he was outed by other SAS soldiers who were every bit as brave, every bit as patriotic, or more so, really, because he wasn't what he pretended to be. And but they'd say they'd gone up the Congo with a reference to the Joseph Conrad novel or the Apocalypse Now, a kind of mixture of both. Which meant that they weren't trying to actually kill Taliban. They were trying to terrorize the population by doing things, by just grabbing a random bloke, throwing him off the cliff. When this guy got thrown off the cliff, it was in full view of people, and they shot him when he got down the bottom. And when he didn't shoot, Ben Robert Smith, according to the allegations, which has been proved, he didn't shoot the guy himself. He got other people to do it, and that wasn't an accident. That meant that they couldn't squeal on you. They were now involved. I mean, you told them to do it, but once they did it, they could hardly go and give evidence against you.
Ordering other SAS to do it at first, and then I kept digging into this, and as you hinted, he told the interpreter to tell an Afghan to shoot this Afghan man.
Yeah,
right.
In that case, he got an Afghan to do it, but there was another case where he got a rookie to do it.
Yeah, it's blooding.
But he's complicit himself. I mean, he's saying you need to shoot this guy. There's a lot of sort of Hollywood references because it reminds me of that. A movie which I really like, the Brad Pitt movie Fury, where they do that when they've got a young guy. And there's, in that movie, you can see that there is some sort of justification when you've got a young rookie who is he's not prepared to fire on children. But in this case, it wasn't justified, you know.
Unjustified. Yeah, because I just wanted to kind of point out, sorry to cut into you there, Dave, but there were basically six murders that were discussed in this case, right? Like, so he was suing the papers for accusing him of having murdered people. And then I think out of the six, the judge said or ruled three of them to be true based on, hanging on the probabilities of what testimony and facts the judge had seen, right? So at least three of them are likely true.
And the judge was very fair. The judge was very, very good judge. We were lucky in this case. Justice was lucky. We had a very good judge who took a long time to write his judgment. It was like 600 pages long. I think that's the one of them. And there's a classified, and that's a big judgment. There were 60 witnesses or something. And he really was very judge-like in the sense that in the cases, even though he knew it was a very serious allegation to make, he said, I'm satisfied in these three cases that it's Well, he didn't say beyond reasonable doubt, but he said it's clear that this is what happened. And also there were other things, because he said, in judge language, he said Robert Smith was an unreliable witness, which means he's a liar. and there were lots of, luckily there were lots of different incidents, and it didn't just have to come down to that. Like he buried some USB sticks right. in his back garden, and his own wife, it seems, gave evidence against him to say, yeah, no, he buried that. And she had very detailed, they're in a pink.
This whole thing is a labyrinth.
Container or something. Yeah. It had a ring of truth about it. And then he counterclaimed against her, and he told her he was going to take the children off her. He had a mistress. Now, it wasn't, the judge was good. The judge said, I'm not satisfied. The mistress's story wasn't particularly clear. And the judge was good enough to say, I can't find with any certainty that he hit the mistress.
Right, because that was also involved.
The fact that he even had a mistress, and he told his wife,
"Yeah,
you need to lie and pretend we were broken up." And she was going to for a while, and then she got, because then I think she just began to see, as you would, your wife, you're married to someone, you always give them the benefit of the doubt, but she just began to see that he was full of shit, and had been for a while, and he threatened her, he's going to take the children away, and I think that. One of the while the judge only made three sort of those serious findings, one of the things that really sunk him in the eyes of Australia was all the little shitty things that he did. You know, he had he burnt his computer with petrol so that police couldn't get it, and then when he asked about it, he said with a straight face, "Yeah, doesn't everybody, you know, burn their computer with petrol?" And the whole mistress thing, the mistress had an abortion, and it looked, and he sent a private investigator to, to make sure she really was having an abortion, and he sent letters to other SAS people saying, you know, if you give evidence, I'm going to burn your house down. And
God, I feel like he spent more effort trying to hide the affair than the killings.
Exactly. I think a lot of people lost faith in him. Yeah, more because of the affairs than actually. There's still a lot of people in Australia. They don't necessarily come out and say it. Usually they're on Twitter with assumed names or fake names, and they still love him. And they're like, oh, well, war is war. All these backyard warriors saying, oh, war is war, and you know how it is. But the problem is with him, he didn't run that defense. If he'd come out and done the old Colonel Jessop, you can't handle the truth. Yes, I kill people, but I kill people to save Australian lives or something. He would have had a chance, but he didn't say that.
He said, didn't even
I've
bother
never
doing
done
that.
Anything
huh?
wrong? He actually the lawyers were good. They trapped him at the beginning, possibly because he was such a pathological liar. They said, "Do you understand what the rule?" And he had a lot of gouts. He could have said the rules of engagement were bullshit. They didn't apply. But he didn't. He said, I absolutely understood the rules of engagement. I would never, ever commit a crime. You know, they do what they call shut the gates. They got him to say he was an angel. And also he was a bit of a dog about it. He probably burned my house down for saying that. But
God forbid.
I know, coming from other SAS people, he didn't just say they were mistaken. He said the people that gave evidence against him are liars and dogs and cowards. And these are people that have spent 20, just like him.
Yeah, weren't they also, most of the people giving testimony SAS, whether for
Absolutely.
Or against?
The people, it was painted, and he still got people painting it. It was painted as him versus the journalist, but it wasn't. It was other, obviously braver, stronger SAS people who were not, a bit like me, they'd seen blood. That, you know, people say that about me. They try to imply that, you know, I've been around the world and I've seen some stuff. And you could still speak up even though you see bad.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a line, and he had crossed that line. He didn't even, you know, he ran across that line. There was no, these were not cases of, could have gone one way or the other. I was a bit tired and
I mean
a bit shaken up. This was something like, we are going to kill this bloke. We are going to rip his head off, and then we're going to say he was an insurgent. And no
really
trying to tell the truth about it, I'm going to kill you. And there were things which have a ring of truth about it, where he said things like to other SAS people, I just want to get someone in a room and I want to blow him away and I want to look at the face. You know, I want to watch his face as he dies.
Yeah, I think he said that it's the most beautiful thing he's ever seen or something like this. God,
yeah, shooting a teenager in the face, you know. And another time I want to strangle someone and I want to watch the life force go out of him just to see what it's like. And they all had the ring of truth about it. They weren't all proved, but they certainly weren't disproved. And
but
the fact that he wouldn't admit he'd done anything wrong ever, and the fact that he was trying to burn other people's houses down, and he almost got one SAS bloke killed because he called.
Oh, really?
The cops. Yeah, he called the cops and said, oh, this guy's got a gun and he's dangerous and he's at home. And the SWAT team came to his house.
Yeah.
And it could have been death by cop for this guy. If he'd come out swinging or not not been compliant, the cops could have shot him. And that was exactly Robert Smith's plan. And that's pretty bloody sinister.
That's one of his own people doing that. Yeah, doing that to one of his own people, right? I mean,
you know, for all this sake, like, oh, I'm a proud soldier.
That's what I wanted to say.
Put my country
yeah.
first. Proud soldiers don't do that. They don't go and kill their bloody workmate just because their workmates.
I mean,
don't say what they want.
The three that were proven, just so we can keep count, the three that were proven. I think. You mentioned. I think it's so brutal, right? I have trouble kind of just explaining it to people. One of them you mentioned is basically he kicked someone off of a cliff, a man, and then when he saw the man wasn't dead, he got the interpreter to tell an Afghan to shoot him. So that's one of the murders. Then the other one is he killed someone with a prosthetic leg. And now I think we come to the most disgusting one of all, if you could even, you know, quantify them. He took the guy's leg and then they used it as a drinking vessel in a bar. I mean, when I read this and the pictures, I saw the pictures, what do I say? Help me, David.
You know, funny enough,
it's so evil.
Being a soldier, that didn't bother me too much. Although when I was in Afghanistan in 2000, I met some Taliban. They were our guides around there, and there was one in particular that I didn't mind. I could see he was a soldier. If you're a soldier, this is before 9/11, of course, and if you're a soldier, you can get on with other soldiers, whatever they represent. And he had a prosthetic leg, and I've often wondered whether he was the guy 10 years later that they'd shot. And drank out of it. I don't think that the dead guy, if he could speak, the dead guy, I don't think he'd particularly care whether they were using his leg as a prosthetic. I think they probably
he'd probably be more pissed off that he was murdered, I suppose. Yes.
Yeah. He'd be annoyed. And well, not say they'd be the Taliban were angels, but they would be annoyed that the Australians lied about it and got medals for being brave, when actually all they'd done is just blown someone away who was standing there with handcuffs on.
I think that
they would just think, you know, they'd be right. They'd say, own your own actions. And honesty is important for them. And they'd be saying, well, fucking, you know, you're just full of shit when you went home and told your wives and your fellows how brave you were, and you went to the left and went to the right, and then you got up and used your superior skills to outshoot the Taliban, when actually you took this guy out with handcuffs on, stuck him in a field and blew him away.
Yeah, it's an execution.
You talked about it like it was bravery. I imagine that Taliban's ghost would be going, yeah, you were pretty fucking brave when you shot me lying on the ground with handcuffs. I think he'd be allowed to at least. I like to think maybe he made anyone that drank out of it gave them a bad stomach.
I'm just going to put this up quickly, but yeah, basically this was in with Americans as well. So you had Americans and Australians in this bar. Is that correct?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, again, it's hard for me because I'm when I'm in the middle, I don't. You end up making. You probably have this problem with you too. You sometimes, unless you're extreme on one side or extreme on the other side, you're going to get people from both sides hating you. I don't think that drinking was too much of a problem. What was annoying about that was that Robert Smith again just denied it and said, in fact, I think he even said, yeah, that would be a disgusting thing to do, to drink out of.
You're right, he said that. Yeah, and then the pictures were
just hypocritical. I mean, because he obviously didn't think that. So why didn't he just say, well, you know, war's tough and this is what happened? But he was like, no, that would be terribly disrespectful. I would never do that.
And right, and like, this is so after the pictures have come out. Yeah, he's like, I thought it was vile at the time.
Yeah, and it was like, he couldn't, what do they say, he couldn't tell the truth when the truth would do. And that's not the sort of person you want looking after Australians. And a lot of Australians were like, he's just, people, especially the right-wingers, they can't shake it that he's not a good person. But you'd say, if he's that untrustworthy, there's no reason why he wouldn't come back to Australia and rape your daughter and kill her. And then you'd be upset. Then you wouldn't be saying, oh, we could never put our soldiers on trial. Then you'd be bleating. Then you'd be bleating for the nearest investigative journalist to actually do something for you.
Yeah.
Don't think that just if people this murder behavior. In Afghanistan, that they're not going to murder in Australia.
Exactly.
All these people that say, oh, we shouldn't put soldiers on trial, they'd be very happy to put soldiers on trial if their own interests were threatened by soldiers.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of racism. They think, oh, brown people don't matter. They only shot a brown person.
Do you think that's a big factor with Ben Robert Smith or in general?
I think it is. You know, people. It's the same with China now. There's a certain amount of inability for people to think that somehow Afghans didn't deserve it, and somehow if a woman had her head blown off for no particular reason in her own house, somehow something about her deserved it because. Because the Taliban, you know, were her fault or something like that. There's no sympathy at all for many thousands of people that had bombs dropped on their house. Like there was a real, we had this kind of childish view. Oh, we were there in Afghanistan to help the women and children.
Yeah.
We killed thousands of women. You can't go to school if you're dead. And yet no one kind of thought of that. What about all the bombs we dropped in order to create safe conditions for Afghan women? We killed a lot more Afghan women than we ever allowed to go to school. And we weren't there to make them go to school. We were there for our own geopolitical interests. But people, I do believe it's racism. Yeah. If someone, an Australian woman, got killed by the police,
they'd be more outraged,
an outcry. But there seems to be an Afghan woman getting killed. People are like, oh yeah, oh well, soldiers are soldiers, you know. And that's clearly wrong. We have it in relation to China now too, you know. It's probably clearer in Russia. It's kind of funny. We used to have to hate the Russians because they were communists.
Right.
Communists wanted to, you know, they were godless people who wanted to take our lifestyle away, you know. And now the Russians are not communists, but strangely, we still have to hate them.
Yeah.
And
for some reason,
weird. I mean, why do we hate them now? That, you know, they're not communists, and it's actually some sort of racism that no matter what they do. Apart from be, you know, a part of the United States, we have to hate them. Same with China.
I agree people with you. This logic is present.
Yeah. Like I'm seeing more and more, which is good, but, you know, stories from people saying China's not the way it's portrayed in the West. And a few good guys on Twitter, French bloke. And some people just refuse to believe it. You know, they just cannot believe that some people in China are happy with the regime, that they have eradicated poverty. They have done a lot of things, and what they're doing with the Uyghurs is certainly better than what we did with the Afghans.
Yeah, like we suddenly care about Muslims now, you know.
Yeah, we didn't just... And it's amazing the hypocrisy we have saying, oh, my God, they treat Muslims so badly when we can't see what we did in Iraq and Afghanistan and... Syria and
Guantanamo Bay,
and yet we want to sort of point the finger at them and just say, "Well,
that's rich."
And a lot of it is just racism, you know. Chinese, and we had it here. You can see the old newspapers in Australia because the Chinese or some Chinese nationals were in Australia quite early. Mm-hmm. They came with the convicts, and they were certainly big in the gold rush, and they were hated then, you know. You could kill a Chinese national in Australia 200 or 300 years ago and probably get away with it by saying it was their fault. You know, a lot of them got robbed and murdered and there's some terrible stuff. We had some, funnily enough, there's a Muslim friend of mine who's a bit of a historian, and she's researched there were Afghans in Australia, cameleers. They bought them out to build the railway, the very long railway between North and South Australia. I think to put the telegraph in, some sort of these engineering feats. And because they had skill in the desert, they came out with the camels and they helped put the radio telegraph in, which is through very inhospitable country. And and there was a few of them, and they one of them married a white woman who had been abused by her husband or whatever, and they experienced terrible racism and violence against them, even though they were these sort of peaceful guys who did a very good job running camels. You know, they built a mosque, and that was considered quite outrageous, and they weren't allowed to live with the whites. You know, it makes you cringe, but that's not even that long ago. You know, it's quite endemic with us.
And, I wish I remembered this story, but I think there was a really good cricketer, and when the team went for a pint, he had to sit outside. Which that when I was growing up, and I heard this story, I was. Like you said, just
there's
it's
a
so
lot of
cringy.
Terrible history like that in Australia. The first Australian cricket team were Indigenous, and they were really good, and they went to England, but I think then they were banned or something. They weren't allowed to play, and the Indigenous diggers who went to join the military and went to the First and Second World War, mm-hmm. when they came back, they weren't allowed to go to the IRS, which is just, when you imagine the anger you must have felt.
You got people in Africa who fought for France, same treatment after the war.
You can imagine, you could see what that would make you, mm-hmm. a terrorist. You would say, how dare you? You know, after I've fought for you, you sort of treat me like a dog.
It's horrible.
It is.
Even Alan Turing, you know, they chemically castrated him after he cracked Enigma with the Polish.
I mean, that would send you mad. I mean, it would send you absolutely mad, you know?
Yeah.
Turing, that's a heartbreaking case for to think that they hounded him.
Christ, I couldn't believe this.
Of respect, even though he was, if you had to put winning the war on a particular person, it would be on him, because that code breaking was absolutely.
I'm speaking to you on the computer. Not this specific one, but you know, he's also credited as the father of the modern computer. So you know, you and I were able to converse. Thanks to his work, and of course, winning World War II like you said, if you had to put, you know,
and yet
give
the
victory.
Police hounded him because he was gay, yeah? And they just could not accept that. You know, all his good work that he'd done meant nothing, you know?
It's heartbreaking.
It's kind of outrageous, and it says a lot about the West that we haven't come to grips with our hypocrisy.
Unfortunately. And I have to say, unfortunately, I agree with you, David, because I think towards Russia, towards China, there's some kind of racism, you know, that's deep seated in Europe, in the West. I think most people, they don't realize that they've been conditioned and duped into just hating the Russians. You know, it doesn't matter whether they're communist or not.
Yeah, I know. Absolutely. And that's why that Russia gate was so important, because Trump, the possibility of sort of relatively peaceful relations with Russia was just something that they could not deal with. I noticed this when I was in Afghanistan, in the sense that the problem with fighting the Muslims, and it really was a war on Muslims, you couldn't sell enough expensive equipment. I mean, it was ridiculous. We phased out perfectly good aircraft for our purposes in Afghanistan, the Warthog. And
right, I was about to say A-10, yeah.
Yeah, everybody loved the A-10, you know, the special forces, and because it was slow and it hit the target, and you knew you were going to be all right if the A-10 arrived on the scene. We got rid of them and replaced them with the F-35 or whatever, which wasn't nearly as good.
They do different jobs, don't they?
Yeah, which, you know, imagine if you're going at Mach 2 or whatever, it's pretty hard to hit the target. especially in a place like Afghanistan where there's civilians and you need sort of accurate fire. And it was 10 times more expensive, or probably 100 times more expensive. And and I could sense that the big munitions manufacturers didn't, it's probably the main reason why we withdrew from Afghanistan. It was expensive, but it wasn't expensive enough, you know, for Boeing and whatever. And
I see.
They really wanted war with a technological power like Russia or China, because that meant you could sell more equipment. You know, you could sell battleships, you could sell, you know, aircraft carrier and all sorts of stuff, which really cost big money. And
that's a very good point. Yeah, that's a very good point.
And that's why I think the real reason we pivoted to Russia, and I could see it even before we left Afghanistan. There was a story in the New York Times, and it was like a bit like this sort of blowing up of the pipeline. It was obviously false. And one of the advantages I've got is that working as a military lawyer, one of the jobs you've got to do is to sign off on false information where we put out in order to confuse the enemy or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Have to say we're in one town when we're actually in another town or whatever. But when there was a story saying, oh, Russians are paying a bounty to Afghans to American soldiers. Now, that was clearly a false
funny
story. You know, you don't need to pay Afghans money to kill Americans in their country. But it was made to beat up the pivot hatred from Afghans to Russians.
I see.
And it ran and ran. And of course, the only source was intelligence sources, which who are paid to lie. So why would they tell the journalists of the New York Times the truth? And I could see that was that pivot. And there's been, this is why they've been so successful with Putin and Ukraine, is that they spent 20 years putting out propaganda against Putin. And now, it's got to such a state now, they could unilaterally bomb Moscow with nuclear bombs, I think, and probably 60% of the West would say, good on you, that's fantastic,
probably
Putin is a monster. And because they've spent 20 years doing anti-Putin stories,
I mean,
and no one...
They've already drone-striked it. Them.
Yeah, exactly. And then they can even get away with it. They can say, oh, the Russians did that themselves. That was some sort of false. That was the Russian, you know, Putin haters that did it, you know?
Yeah, of course.
And they can get away with that kind of rubbish. And even if someone like Seymour Hirsch exposes them, he gets rubbished and, you know, vilified. And so we have this terrible perfect storm now where it's anyone that talks the truth, which goes against the US narrative, is just destroyed. And you can say something totally ridiculous and get away with it.
Yeah.
And the only source you need is security systems. We've learned a lot of really bad lessons from the Vietnam War. I used to think we have evolution, positive evolution, but it seems to be negative evolution, in that they've learned that the reason that they lost the Vietnam War was because people saw the truth from journalists in the field. So
right
now they make sure there's only embedded journalists who are with the military, and they're thankful for the military for getting them this meal ticket, and they kind of got a little bit of homoerotic love for the soldiers, and and they write these beautiful about how good. I mean, like, no one, the biggest kept secret, everybody who was there knew the Afghan War wasn't going well, but you never saw it in any major paper. You never saw the sort of stuff about it. Now, that's outrageous. 20 years, you never really saw any big expose to say, even just the money that was being wasted and going into contractors' pockets and then back to US companies, you never even saw a story about that.
Yeah.
Now, that's an incredible cover-up. 20 years is a long time to keep that lid on that secret.
You do a disservice to yourself and Assange, because you guys, you two, you are the ones who did the exorcism.
And also, disservice to yourself, because without people like you, we'd be dead. And this is independent media literally save the world.
Well, let's do it together, because I don't even know what to say. Like now, when they're hitting Moscow with drones, and it's just like, okay, whatever, it's normal. I mean, in the Cold War, this was unthinkable, you know, that you would have a hot war or
bring
any
back
kind
the
of
Cold War. It was so much better when I was in NATO. On the Russian, well, we were in West Germany, on the sort of East German border, on the Soviet bloc border, and it was better then than it is now, I can tell you. There was less, you know,
I believe you,
less hysteria, less false stories. We were further. We certainly weren't going to unilaterally attack Russia. We were actually a defensive organization. And we were only there for defense. That was our job.
Back then, I said this when I gave a few speeches, that we could have had a different conversation, but in the 1960s or in the Cold War. But we're not in the Cold War anymore. So there's no Soviet Union. There's no reason for NATO
NATO should have been disbanded in the 90s, you know.
The Warsaw Pact was, so. Fair is fair.
Yeah, exactly. It's reason for being. And of course, this is one of the problems with the US. You know, if you've got to really, and this is, we all learn it in history about the causes of World War One. If you just keep building up your military, it's going to be used eventually. I mean, it's not, they say, oh, we need to be prepared, but it's become this, one of the analogies I use for my book is the snake that bites its own tail, in that we put in a tax on basically on ourselves, situations that we've created ourselves, and like a snake biting its tail, you get some sort of quick adrenaline hit because you think you've caught on to some prey or something like that, so you think it's good and you hold on all the more tighter. And the tail panics because it's been attacked by something and doesn't realize it's being attacked by itself. And of course the snake wriggles and bites and wriggles and bites as hard as it can until it dies.
Worse.
And that's pretty much like the Western system. We keep building up our militaries, they have all this technology. As a result, it gets used. Sometimes we're boxing its shadows, and we get some sort of small term hit for boost in popularity. Biden is obviously got more popular the more he talks about war, the more he commit. They can't give enough money to Ukraine. This is how obscene is this, and this pretty much sums up what's wrong. If they wanted $6 trillion in Ukraine, they would get it. And yet you've got people on the streets of the United States starving, living in tents.
It's shameful.
Know, there's that huge crisis with this sort of artificial heroin. And there are huge problems in the U.S. now, and they don't give a shit. Yet Zelensky can ask for a gold-plated Cadillac, and it'll be there in minutes.
That's nothing.
It's that's obscene. And if you were an American doing it tough, how would you feel? If you were a veteran with lost your legs or something, fighting for your country, living in
that's how they treat them. Like the VA is notorious for being bad. It's notorious for being bad.
Afghanistan. It's a way. War is a way to turn public money into private money. You know, they give a contract to McDonnell Douglas or Boeing or Northrop, and they and it's for whatever $1 trillion, but they know they're going to get $1 billion back through political donations, secret share deals, all sorts of, you know, Cayman Islands. The politicians are going to get a share of that back. So, and yet the money that they gave wasn't politicians' money, it was taxpayer money.
There you go.
So the taxpayer money becomes politicians' money. And of course, a lot of it gets shaved off to the corporates. But it's the people who really lose out from all of this is the American taxpayer. They pay for everything, even no matter how they paid for the Afghan police, you know, huge bills, the Afghan, all these things that are now defunct, all these bases which would be destroyed. And that was all paid for by taxpayers in Mississippi and Tennessee and California, a lot of whom don't even get medical. Well, none of whom get free medical. That's outrageous. True. That's, you know, that's, there should be a revolution in the U.S. Actually, I'm not saying that, I'm going to get arrested, but you would understand that the levels of dissatisfaction in the U.S. Must be very, very high.
Yeah. It's shameful, you know, veteran or otherwise, they don't get any healthcare, and if they do, it's barely, calling it adequate is kind of a, you know, kind of a compliment.
Yeah. It's a disaster. And yet money for Zelensky.
Every second, he's got more than Israel, which is kind of a surprise, right? Like they were number
that's
one.
Saying something.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Saying
truly.
And I went to a good book launch the other night. I'll give my friend a plug, called The Palestinian Laboratory by an author called Anthony Lowenstein, who I really like. And he's very he's a very brave guy. He's Jewish, but he's sort of, I wouldn't say he's anti-Israel, but he's a critic of Israel's excesses, which makes him a target. I'm surprised he's still alive, actually, but he's written this book about, and it's quite worrying. There we go, very very quick, and it's really it's quite depressing in some ways, but very very good. And he's saying that all this sort of technology that Israel is what they called field tested in Palestine about, and it's all pretty sinister. Phone hacking and ways, you know, facial recognition.
There you go. That's very.
Other countries love it.
Yeah, so you've got the you know, regular ordinances and weapons that people think of, but as you mentioned correctly, the cyber warfare. So they're exporting, they're building drones in England and exporting them. I think it's Elbit, and there's
Elbit,
they always shut down the factories. The activists, they're good. And then, as you mentioned, this Pegasus, you know, they blacklist Pegasus, the Americans,
right,
but there are other companies. They just, you have people who made Pegasus who make new companies, and that's it. You know, they're not blacklisted.
No, I saw, I know it's disgusting, and I saw, and the governments can't get enough of it. And I saw something, not even governments, I saw something very worrying the other day. And again, you have to know what to look for to pick up on it. But it was a the equivalent of the Bar Association, a lawyers group in mm-hmm. Victoria, who you'd think it'd be all about human rights, but they had some sort of incident where someone had put an obscene a meme basically up on a wall, and it was in sort of poor taste, but it was not the biggest deal. But the this Bar Association chased the culprits by hacking their email. They hacked all the lawyers' emails looking for the now that's and then they were like, oh yeah, we won't do that again because that's my that may because some of the lawyers were like, what are you doing with
shouldn't they know
some
better
sort of Pegasus system where they just decided to hack everybody's emails and find. And that's just some sort of corporate version of Pegasus where they managed to get hold
right.
of that. Oh yeah, we can go and hack everybody's emails. And that's the Bar Association that did that.
I mean, I'm not quite sure how to respond.
Yeah. I mean, it's
wild.
Like, but yeah, and so rather than sort of people sticking up for sort of human rights, they're just getting trampled left, right, and center. And everyone can justify it. I mean, they say national security. We need to do this for national security. But this Bar Association, they just did it because they wanted to find the culprit for a sort of ugly meme.
Yeah.
You know? So it's not, it's bullshit that it's national security. It's just like
of
naughty,
course.
Naughty kids looking in there, you know, in the spying in their neighbor's window and looking in people's if phones. There's no justification for it. It's just like, oh wow, have you heard what we can buy from Israel? Let's get it, and then we can we can start behaving badly. It's a shame that nobody seems to be outraged by it.
You know, after Snowden came out, you had all these companies that popped out of nowhere trying to kind of capitalize off of this notion that you need a VPN, you need this email to protect you, you need encryption, military-grade encryption. And I was talking about this teenager who's a climate activist, no clue what their name is, but they're part of a group in France who they basically do sit-ins. They go to some cafe or some place and do sit-ins. And the French police saw the person's email, and they asked Proton Mail, which is in Switzerland. One of these companies says, "Oh, we respect your privacy," to hand over the IP address, and they used an Interpol warrant or a Europol warrant, saying it was terrorism. It's a kid who skipped school to do some climate thing. It's outrageous, you know. They can call anyone they like a terrorist, and then use Pegasus,
no
use warrants.
That's one of the big problems. Like, I'm called a terrorist, which means that they can do extra things to me that they couldn't do if I was just a criminal.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Set me up with people who try to. And this is why I'm always, you know, avoiding talking about violence, because once I met someone who I suspect was an agent who was trying to sort of coax me into taking up arms against the country, you know, on some sort of spurious grounds about how the government was run by sort of, it was sort of QAnon stuff, but he was trying to talk me into violence. And then when I said, oh, no, I'm not interested in violent revolution, mm-hmm. He got really angry at me and said, oh, you're just full of hot air. You know, you should be doing more. And it was, I believe he was probably an agent provocateur trying to get something.
So like entrapment or something.
Sort of stuff they can do to you when you're a national security threat like me. And of course, the only real national security threats are whistleblowers. You know, most of our secret intelligence services would be working on anti-government dissenters rather than actual people who
that,
know how to use
unfortunately true you know, I wanted to ask you, David, did you see the latest decision on Julian's case? Because they basically denied his appeal. He's going to reapply, I think, on Tuesday. And you know, as of now, currently, the extradition has been approved, right? So he has to appeal all of that.
I saw that yesterday, yeah.
Yeah.
I was a bit of confusion because I saw I saw Stella Assange say that she was going to, they were going to appeal to the High Court on Tuesday. But then I thought I saw something early this morning that say that that's not going to happen. But
do you think the government in Australia is doing enough? Do you think the new one, because you know, Penny Wong and Albanese, they've talked about Assange, but do you think they're doing enough for him and for you?
They're not. But at least there has been some progress. I mean, that is to their credit. At least they have said we're not comfortable with the situation. Like, that's better than the previous government. Now, that's a long way from victory, but it's certainly on the way, because they can't go back on that now. And while he said enough is enough, and if something happened to Assange, or, you know, he would look pretty bad, because even if he's just saying enough is enough, which is obviously not really particularly good, it means that they are beginning to get concerned.
Mm-hmm.
That is a step in the right direction. Now, obviously, it's, you know, they could do, and as other people have pointed out, and you've mentioned my case, which you, it doesn't make any sense for them to agitate for Julian Assange's release and also put me in jail at the same time. So actually, in a humorous way, Biden could say to them, oh, shut up, you know, you're trying to put your own, you know, war crimes whistleblower in jail for 100 years. So what are you doing coming to me complaining about me doing exactly the same thing as what you're doing?
It's quite a contradiction, to put it mildly.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, yeah. Biden, I mean, as you and I know, of course, the funny thing is behind the scenes, Joe Biden probably doesn't even know who Assange is. He's probably, he's just pushed from pillar to post. And, of course, it's all been run by people behind the scenes, the Mike Pompeos, or, you know, who tell Biden what to say, push him out in front of the cameras, but he would have no say. He could say, I love Julian Assange, and they would just laugh at him and say, shut up, read the lines on the auto cue, and
basically,
and we'll pay you with breakfast if you do a good job. I mean, he's clearly not the decision maker on this, and as soon as it's, you know, national security, it's made by people way above his pay grade. And but making noise in Australia, I think in some ways it'll be quite, there is a silver lining anyway to him losing that appeal, because it causes interest and to go up. And people, apparently the surveys say 80% of Australians, or maybe even 90, want Assange to come home.
Right.
They've tapped into that patriotism. Mm-hmm. They don't necessarily, the average person is quite conservative. They don't like whistleblowers, because they kind of think they're rocking the boat. And there's a certain amount of trust in government, which is probably misplaced, I would say, but mm-hmm. it's still there. But they also are very patriotic, and they don't want to see an Australian stuck in a horrific high security cell under the rocks. It's wrong to say Colorado. When we say Colorado in Australia, you think of Aspen and skiing and you know, beautiful scenes, but of course he's not going to be anywhere near that. He's going to be in some dreadful underground bunker, which could be anywhere. And the average Australian is you know, is quite a sort of conservative but nice bloke, but they don't think that seems right. That an Australian to be subjected to that, and he's not a murderer. He's not really anything but an idealistic sort of person, and to see him crushed, because everybody knows he just embarrassed the US government and they can't handle that. And the idea that they're going to kill him quickly or slowly is not going down well with Australians. And I think that's moving in the right direction anyway. Obviously, there's still got a way to go. But I'm confident that we are going to win both my case and his case.
Yeah.
Maybe before you and I speak again in a year's time, say. It's like I see it in terms of the Second World War. It's not like it's not an overnight victory. It's sort of like a 6-year campaign. We have small victories and battles every day,
right?
And I've seen I've seen rather than dwell on the negative, I've seen good progress in the Assange campaign. I mean, there was a lot of excitement when Stella came to Australia. Last month, because we thought it was going to be AUKUS. There's a lot of anti-AUKUS. We've even had ex-prime ministers, our equivalent of ex-presidents, come out and say that AUKUS is a disaster and subs are a disaster. And that's good. These are powerful, interesting, smart people. In fact, one day I want to make a list on Twitter of people who are on our side and people who are on their side, because increasingly the people on our side are the intelligent, the experienced, people who are sort of admired around the world. They're increasingly on our side, and on their side is looking pretty tatty, you know.
Yeah, especially with Biden.
Mike Pompeo. Yeah, you know, you've got a few dweeby kind of guys.
And, oh, man.
Yeah, their team is not that great, you know.
No.
It really isn't that great.
No, it's not. It's not.
And so that is that, you know, that and that has improved. And I guess it's all about momentum. And but thanks to people like you, you know, you've been doing great work. And it's what I see you.
Thank you, David.
It never stops. There's a guy out here, Michael West, and he does the equivalent of you in about finance and about government rules and about how, you know, and every day,
every day
he's got a new atrocity. And you think, oh, God, it must be kind of hard. But, and you're the same, you know, and you'd be the same. We don't, activists, we don't have time to follow how many terrible things are happening overnight. But because there are so many.
There are so many.
I'm so happy to see that your station has got bigger and bigger.
Thank you very much.
Because it's really important work. And it's a war, but it's a war where we're getting the momentum, you know. Stalingrad passed, El Alamein.
Right.
And we're slowly moving on. Eventually we'll get to Berlin and blow up their swastika.
Yes. Amen.
Makes me happy. We've always got to keep a smile on their face. And I think I said that to you when I spoke to you 3 years ago, whatever it was. We've always got to keep laughing because they would love to see us. They love to see us be in pain or be.
That's true. They want people to give
and
up.
Now our smiles are getting bigger and their smiles are getting a bit smaller.
David, thank you very much for all the kind words. You have an open invitation, and you know, I think all the nice things that you just said, they apply tenfold to you and to Assange, because you guys are really, really not just in the front lines. You guys are at the front. You're in the first wave, going all the way. And I was actually going to ask you, how is the situation now with your case? So, like, what stage are we in now?
Well, we're in Act 3. We have a date for hearing, 13th, lucky 13 of November. It's a 3-week trial. We're trying to get the charges dropped for a while, but we're feeling pretty good about it now. We're happy to go to trial. We think we can get a win either way, in the sense if they put me in jail for a long time, there will be public outcry, a bit like Assange. People don't need to understand.
You can count on it.
Yeah. People don't need to understand the full ins and outs of my case to say if I get put in jail before anybody you know, even a guy that shot someone on, you know, on national TV, he has been charged, but he won't be going to trial for probably years. If I'm the only one from the Afghan-Iraq war who goes to jail for 20 years,
Christ.
People are going to say, really? With all these scandals and rubbish and it's gone on, what exactly did this guy do? Did he really reveal any national security when you've got people who clearly murdered
How does BRS get away with it? I really don't understand this.
Well, he's probably flying around the world in a private jet now.
I heard he's in Bali.
He was in Bali for the getting his back rubbed for the trial. Yeah, he's not really doing it tough. He's probably going to go and work for some private security company.
We'll have an Australian Blackwater next.
He's probably. I don't think he's doing it tough. So yeah, and those offences, even though it was a defamation action, those offences were proved. So it's going to. You know, I almost wish will them to put me in jail because nothing will make a blow up in their face more. Then putting me in jail and then trying to justify while I'm in jail when there's all these other people and not just the corporals, but generals with big question marks over them. And they're, you know, living the big life in their mansions or traveling around. There's all these kind of corporate crooks. We've had a big scandal with PricewaterhouseCoopers where they were stealing government secrets and giving them to their clients so they could avoid tax. And now while there's been a little bit of a scandal about it, no one's been charged. They're unlikely to be charged, let alone go to jail. They're probably not going to miss next year's Aspen trip. And yet, you know, I'm in jail. But that's going to sit very badly for the government to say, this guy, even my enemies say, oh, look, I was a well-intentioned person. Who believes, you know, I'm a little bit wound up, a bit tight and, you know, believes too much in the rule of law and doesn't, you know, whatever they say, there's no one that can say I'm a spy. I've got no connection to any other country. I never made any money out of what I did. It's going to be very hard for them to sort of keep me in jail for 20 years when all these people who clearly did some very bad stuff are prospering and, you know, and got money in their pockets, you know. And my book's going to come out before the trial too, and that's going to be
cool. You have to come here to plug it.
I'll be back on next time to get that up. It'll just be before the trial comes out. So we'll plug it and see if we can get on a bestseller list. That will really, they'll hate that. We'll get the Russians to buy it.
You better use rubles. Those dollars are not
going to get it translated into Russian. Russian and Chinese. one thing I would like, and this is serious, I would like it put into Afghan language and Arabic, because I'd love people in the Middle East to see there at least is someone from the Western worlds who can see the hypocrisy and lies for what they are and to a certain extent wants to apologize for it, or at least, you know, someone who stood up, because I think that would be nothing would help peace more than us cleaning our side of the street and saying at least one person say I can see we were full of shit. And it must be incredibly hurtful for you. I am here. This is one of my big, I guess, dreams, is to go back to Afghanistan, go back to the Middle East as some sort of peace ambassador. And of course, the best way to start that process is to say, this is the truth. We did this wrong. We did that wrong. We did that wrong. And that doesn't mean that the others, you know, other sides won't do well. But that if you want to start a decent dialogue, start with the truth and start with admitting your fault.
Absolutely.
I would love to do that, and this is a good way.
It's
to start
very
that.
Noble. It's very noble, yeah. and you know, coming to terms with your own history. I think it's just critical thinking. It's but in your case, it comes from a place of real reflection and love, and it's a noble endeavor.
People like you, it works. I mean, we had a guy, an SAS bloke, who would witness. He didn't murder anybody, but he was part of a team where someone was murdered. So again, not a Taliban. We came into town. The SAS came into town. They shot the first bloke they saw.
Just drop a knife then on the body.
He was wounded, and then they. There was no. The sort of supporters and haters go, oh, they were just killing Taliban. This is another situation where they clearly just shot a random.
Mm-hmm.
Shot a random, and he wasn't dead. He was wounded in the leg. And then the sergeant took this random off to a private room, said, where are the Taliban? The guy was like, I don't know, whatever. And then the sergeant kicked him to death. Christ. This guy wasn't Taliban, but he's funny enough, his family ended up joining the Taliban.
I wonder why.
A witness, one of the other members of the patrol who saw this, and he knew he didn't do enough. He didn't stop it. Not that it would have been easy to.
I see what you mean.
But still, people being people, and he's obviously a very good person. He felt very, very guilty about this. Chewed him up over a period of years.
Wow.
He wanted to make a bit like recompense. You know, he wanted to ideally go to Afghanistan, go back to this village, and actually say, "I'm sorry." And COVID made that impossible. And
right.
So he did it by Zoom. And, you know, the typical sort of racist scenario in Australia was don't do that. They're just only going to ask for money whatever, don't give an inch. But because he did it, and of course it wasn't what people said, and the family were only they weren't even sort of angry and outright. They were impressed that he had the honor to make the call and to say, I should have done more. I'm sorry, your father's dead, and I should have done more. Now, that impressed them. They didn't say, give me some money or, how dare you, or, violent. They were impressed that he had the honor. And while it's obviously a sad call and they're not exactly going to celebrate, it's still, it was honor to honor. They kind of acknowledged it. And they also, they've lived for war all their lives, the last 50 years. It wasn't as if he was beyond their bounds of understanding. They knew that in war, soldiers would kill people or whatever. But what did annoy them was that we lied about it,
It's like adding insult to injury, kind of.
Yeah, that's the hypocrisy that, got to them more than anything else, that we would come there and say, oh, we had to fight for our lives against these, Taliban, and actually we shot someone who was holding a shovel and then we kicked him to death, That's... Yeah. You can imagine, you can see, and this is one of the great myths, because we used to say, oh, the Taliban, they brainwashed kids in these madrasas and they tortured them and brainwashed. It's the only reason why anyone would join the Taliban, as if they've been brainwashed. They didn't have to brainwash them. Stories like that got out and people wanted to join the Taliban, and you can understand why, the truth was enough to make people join the Taliban.
You can find similar stories in Iraq and Vietnam, right? Yeah. Like, oh, they're just brainwashed. Yeah, exactly. It's nothing to do with us.
Brainwashed. They're robots. They're not real people. And, no real person would support that. Yeah, if they sort of hear about stories, they didn't have to make up lies it's, to get people to do.
Well, the same thing in Ireland as well. You know, you had people joining the IRA after what?
Well, I was there, of course. Yeah, now propaganda wasn't. We didn't try to lie quite so blatantly. We knew that they were people fighting for self-determination, and didn't try to say that they were. I don't think so, anyway. But it was just. Our propaganda was lies, not theirs. You know, they needed to do was to tell the truth. And this is why it made me so angry, because I was a true believer in the Western forces, but we became the people that we said we weren't. You know, we became the people that we said we enemies were. You know, we put out the false statements. We killed the civilians and said they were Taliban. They didn't need to lie to recruit. They recruited because the average person knew the truth, that we were full of shit and that they were fighting for their country against collaborators and foreigners. And I saw it in a few telltale signs, a bit like the Viet Cong. One of them was their soldiers fought for rice. Our soldiers fought for money, you know. And you know that you're on a loser when your people won't pick up a piece of paper, let alone a rifle, unless you give them $100. Whereas the other guys are fighting with fury in their heart and happy to get some free rice. That is when you're on a loser. And we put out all the sort of false.
It becomes projection, stories, you know? Like all the things you just described. It's really just projection in the end. And I say that a lot because everything we say that today in, you know, 2023, it's the Russians and the Chinese. Everything we accuse them of doing, it's actually...
I had a big tweet, when the Ukraine war started, and somebody said to me, trying to catch me out, saying, you know, do you think the invasion of Ukraine is illegal? And I said, well, you can't enforce the law against one country and not against another. And if the invasion of Iraq wasn't illegal, or we didn't punish anybody as a result, put it that way, we can't start punishing Putin for doing the same thing. You know, the law is only the law if it's applied consistently. And then I went into a longer one just saying, I don't remember the Russians having any black sites where they took people to Kazakhstan or Thailand and tortured them to death, specifically because those countries did not have anti-torture legislation. I don't remember the Russians doing, things like General Petraeus, who was in charge of all the wars, and yet he had a bevy of six mistresses that female lieutenants that he was having sex with in turn, and at the same time pretending to be some sort of moral crusader. You know, I went through the list. I can't remember them now, but we say the Russians are bad. And yet we're the ones with the secret torture sites where we kill people, often innocent people. We just take them off the streets, take them to some country, deliberately selected, torture them to death. Yeah, projection is exactly right. And I was cringing when I saw that horrible Victoria Nuland.
Jesus Christ.
Oh, the Russians. Yeah, they often do stuff and try to blame it on us.
It's straight out of the Russian playbook, right? They love this stuff.
I know, and you think that just makes Christ. My blood boil. And then when Seymour Hersh, you know, pretty much conclusively proved that they blew up the Nord Stream, he was attacked by, you know, Washington Post and New York Times. You know, they have, in some ways, you've got to take your hats off to the CIA in the way that they have successfully infiltrated the major news networks so seamlessly. But it's a sad, you know, we are heading for a dystopian future, if we're not already there. where it's slightly different than in the sort of sci-fi movies, because it's CNN, it's all these things that you think are normal journalists are actually putting out government propaganda. They're not dressed in government uniforms, but you and I know that they actually are government operatives in good disguises, you know, African Americans and the people that you don't think, oh, he's a government operative. But when you start listening to what they're saying, you think
they all sound the same.
Government operatives.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
And that's something which changed in my lifetime, and it's one of the most worrying things. I mean, the New York Times and the Washington Post helped stop the Vietnam War, and they exposed the Watergate, and they brought a government down, and at risk of going to prison, and now that is
they're
so
different
far,
different papers,
you know, now they are actually working for the government, and in the worst possible way, not just putting out happy messages, but actually running down people like Seymour Hersh.
The funny thing is, different. Washington Post, they themselves have admitted 2 days ago that Ukraine was telling the United States about wanting to blow up Nord Stream. So, it's like BBC, they come 20 years later and say, they'll interview someone who says that, the Warner arc was a mistake and so on. But when it matters, they never actually tell the truth, right?
Yeah, it's a bit like... I know, that's worries me. I mean, it's more than just a game that can destroy the world. I mean, one of the scenarios I can see, again with a little bit of military inside knowledge. This is not classified information. Don't want anyone to get arrested, but it's highly likely that the US want a war in China. And they will start one with a
false flag
attack.
I was going to ask you about this.
Yeah, they will start one with a false flag attack. And we need people like the New York Times and Washington not to come in 10 years, like you said, 10 or 20 years later to say, oh, yeah, it's a false flag attack when no one really cares. They need to be aware of it and start outing the military now, because that's a serious... No one's going to benefit. I mean, one of the things I'm trying to do with Assange is actually start putting pressure on American corporations to do more for him. People like Nike and the sort of stuff who are ubiquitous around the world, and to say, you're not blameless here unless you're either with Assange or against him. And if you're mm-hmm. not making noises about him to the your government sponsored representatives, you are against him, and you would need to you're not going to be selling many Nike training shoes if there's a nuclear war with China. No one's going to want to go jogging if there's nuclear waste floating in the air, and I can assure you in California there will be. Reckon the Nike training shoe company might be trying to stop a war because it ain't going to be good for sales. I think a lot of their stuff is sold in China and made in China anyway. So what's going to happen to all their factories, you know? So they have an interest to actually do some more about saying, really, you want to have a false flag attack in China? And, you know, maybe the hawks in Washington think, oh, yeah, China's becoming an industrial power and we need to do whatever we can. But hopefully some saner heads in the corporate world will be saying, I don't know whether
it's going
to
be
good for sales.
I can't believe we have to depend on the corporations to come save the planet. It sounds a bit weird.
They're the power in America. You know, it's seamless, you know. It's not as if like... And we talked about it in Washington, you know, the security services within the papers now, but there is such a, in fact, it's wrong to even say there's a revolving door between,
true,
you know, Boeing and Northrop and the military.
It's the
same
way.
it's become the same organization. You know, you could probably get posted from the military to Boeing and back to the military, and you wouldn't even consider that you've actually left the military, you know.
Yeah.
It is it's effectively the same thing now. And the big corporations are the same. They obviously don't pay tax, or they don't pay much tax, and they're expanding all around the world. And while it is sad that we have to we have to sort of beg a corporation to do something on for truth in geopolitics, I think they're particularly vulnerable to it because, you know, Nike are always sponsoring football programs, soccer programs in Taiwan or anywhere. In fact, you know, getting more Muslim women to play soccer or something like that, and they've got lots of feel good stuff on their website. But you need to call them on it and say, you know, you've tried to be a force for good. What are you doing about the greatest force for good in the world, Julian Assange and truth? And maybe you should make a statement about that rather than just selling us glossy ads about the sort of good work you do around the world. This is a really important thing. Take a stand.
Yeah.
And show us that you're not just trying to sell more shoes.
Take a stand for David McBride as well, because, you know, like you said, it's
nice.
One camp, it's one team.
That would be nice. And because it is about truth. I'm not trying to put it in. I'm happy for people to make profits. And I'm happy for them to, but it's not going to benefit anybody. These new age hawks seem to think, oh yeah, when we use all this Israeli technology and we basically lock people down like in a sci-fi movie, they think that's going to be good. But they do not know, haven't they seen Terminator or whatever? They do not know that it's going to cause a revolution. There might only be a small number of us, but the David McBrides of the in 50 or 60 years' time, not me, security services, don't come around, but my descendants will go to war. You know, if it really does become this horrible new, terribly oppressive, lack of justice. They may have control of 80% of the population, but the other 20% are going to be angry, and they're going to be armed, and they're going to blow it all up. And it's not going to be some sort of wonderful, peaceful world run by corporations. It's going to be a civil war everywhere.
I think most people have the same opinion. They're opposed to the war in Ukraine. They're opposed to just sending billions and trillions to Ukraine and having, you know, a bad relationship with Russia. But they don't show it. They don't want people to know that actually
People are scared. People are quite rightly scared because you could get locked away. And we've seen it. There's that journalist you would know in the UK from the Grey Zone. And he's only published real information about the truth about Boris Johnson and whatever. And the cops, when he came into Heathrow, they treated him like he was Osama bin Laden. That's the future.
They did this to a French journalist also last month, and they asked him if he's a fan of Macron and if he was involved in the protests. And this is in London. I mean, I don't really know too many people who care for Macron, but I think people don't remember that the Terrorism Act of 2000 is actually something that was created to screw with the Irish, right? It was you could be held for 7 days instead of 1 day without charge, and that's what it came out of.
And this is where the crossover with your world and my world, and it's important. We thought we were pretty clever when we did that. And one of the things that we need, I'm speaking to, if there's any marketing geniuses out there, we need a good marketing genius for sort of human rights, because human rights, it sounds very wishy-washy, and it sounds like, oh, yeah, what's that? People that want to, prisoners that want to have 3 meals a day and, you know, exercise machines or something. But it's anything but. And because there's no adult supervision on them, once you've got a law which says you can hold someone for 7 days, It gets abused. It happened in Australia. We did it too, and they got caught. At someone who was a doctor. He was a Muslim doctor, but his cousin was involved in a terrorist incident or something, and they held him for 7 days. And it wouldn't have taken long for them to work out he wasn't involved. You know, he was a fucking doctor, and he really was a doctor, and yet. They, if they could have used, you know, torture techniques or whatever, but they were doing it probably for political reasons. They wanted to, they get angry, they want to hold someone. And yet it's so short-sighted for someone that who kind of believes in the military. You could, if that guy wasn't a terrorist, you know, after 7 days of being brutalized, you know, without any reason for it, you reckon he might become one. Because all this stuff backfires. It doesn't stop terrorism. It makes terrorism. It makes terrorism. And the idea that you would just start arresting people, yeah, and all this stuff that we passed. And at the time, I was like, oh, you know, human rights, you know, that's a bit over the top. And civil liberties, it doesn't sound very sexy, but it does matter because like that sort of famous poem, I can't remember it, but it's something like, you know, they came for the communists and I didn't care because I wasn't a communist, you know, and they came for the, and eventually they came for the journalists and I didn't care because I wasn't an investigative journalist, but eventually they will come for you and don't think that they won't. I am a very middle of the road, middle class guy who went to Oxford University and, my father was famous, went to Sandhurst. I'm not the sort of person you imagine being put in a high security prison for the rest of my life. And so don't think all I did was did my job. There's no suggestion that I actually truly endangered national security. I spoke up because I thought that there were cover-ups and that we'd become highly politicized, and I did it for patriotism. If they're going to put me in jail and make me die in jail, no one is safe. You know, anyone that actually tries to do the right thing can be a terrorist, and that is a problem. You know, because I'm a patriot, as was Snowden for that matter. He just said, "How dare he say that? You know, the head of the NSA shouldn't go on TV and lie to the American public about whether or not
the travesty."
How dare he, you know? And he has to live in Russia now. This is one of the things you forget. Yeah, Russia's the bad. Snowden lives in Russia. He can't go to America.
They cancel his passport. The bad guys. Yeah. They can't. They did it on purpose because they know, you know, they can twist it. But I just wanted to say you're right. You know, if you actually care about the country and you want to. Healthy society, then you don't support these things that they're doing, the wars, the corruption, because it only leads to conflict and it only leads to impoverishment, you know. And
they've got a saying in the law.
It's the opposite of patriotism.
Yeah, a saying in the law. Yeah, that's what makes my skin crawl, because I am more of a patriot. I'm even more of an American patriot than Mike Pompeo, for example. Yeah. Because I believe in, you know, democracy, and I believe in the U.S. Constitution, and I've got lots of good American friends. But it's not patriotism to abuse the law and put people in jail who their only crime was showing that the government committed crime. If the government committed crime, they need their asses kicked. And it's not patriotic. Mm-hmm. To put those whistleblowers in jail. You know, the whistleblowers should be running the military, because they are actually the ones that speak, that actually support the Constitution, that support the rule of law.
Yeah. Yes, especially in your case, because you're, as you said, you know, Oxford, Sandhurst, in the military, you and also a lawyer. So, You have both of these realms.
I've got a pretty good idea, put it that way, yeah.
Right,
And I'm a patriot. One of my deepest ambitions is to go back to the military and as a consultant, and just and to help them sort out the issues that made me forced to do what I do. I'm not anti-military. I'm not anti-US.
Right.
I want to see these systems work, but I'm anti-corruption. I'm anti-bullshit. I'm anti false wars that are created just to sell arms and create a diversion to get crappy politicians reelected. And, you know, that's what I was brought up on. I don't see myself as a revolutionary. I see myself as someone actually trying to make the establishment work and to root out the bad guys, because unfortunately, slowly, the bad guys have taken over the bus. You know, we've been hijacked. You know, the US is not run by good people. It's run by the very worst people.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to set that right, you know. I want to see the US thrive, but it can't be the world's most evil regime. It's got to change its ways and actually become a force for good again.
It has to. And I'd say the same goes for, the UK, obviously. And,
but as it is, I might have to go and live in Russia if I'm ever allowed to leave Australia.
Careful, there's lots of drones flying around Moscow this time of year.
I might get droned. Hillary Clinton might drone me.
Oh, God.
Except they'd probably miss and hit the house next door.
As usual, right? No, but it's all the same story, you know. I remember during the withdrawal of Afghanistan, even then they tried the same old game, like, oh, well, we were following him all day and he was a terrorist. Yeah, and
that's the problem. I mean, this is the sort of reason, this is why I'm so against them. Mistakes happen, no problem. But the fact that they bald-faced lied about that and said, oh, yeah, we got this great terrorist. Yeah, fantastic. You know, high fives all around. And then when questions were asked, they maintained their lies, and then turned out they
who creates these terrorists? You notice every time the United States they kill some ISIS leader in Syria. Guess where he is? They're usually in the vicinity of Idlib, which is Turkey, occupied by Turkey, another NATO member. You know, these guys, when it came to the war in Syria, they all the European countries are turning a blind eye and letting all these foreign fighters through and going off into Syria.
And again, if you're old enough like me, I was young at the time, but I remember the Afghan war in the 1980s when they were sort of sponsoring what they called the Mujahideen, who were really just the forerunners of the Taliban. They were, extreme Islamists who wanted to kill any foreigners and didn't want any progress. So it's ironic. And yet that caused Afghanistan in the 2000s because we smashed the country so badly and we gave anybody who said, I will kill Russians for you. We gave them Stinger missiles, we gave them money, you know.
It's true.
And then they had to suddenly, when the Russians left, they had to run around madly and pay 10 times the price of Stinger missiles to get them off the very people they'd given them to.
What do you think is going to happen in Ukraine?
They created a monster. Yeah, we created Osama bin Laden, us and the Saudis. And that's what's going to happen in Ukraine. We're not going to let the neo-Nazis take over. And once if the Russians go, and they probably will eventually after a 10-year horrible war, and where Ukraine is in ruins, we're gonna have these crazy people, a bit like Syria. I could see it happening again in Syria, who are like disgruntled, who are armed, have got money, and they're gonna go to the US and blow up buildings in the US. And it's not gonna be Ukraine's fault, it's going to be the US's fault, because this is they've reaped the whirlwind, as they say. We've created this thing And it's going to come back and bite us. We've created this crazy snake, and we think it's going to attack the Russians, but it could just as easily attack us.
You notice how these terrorists, they always have files and photographs of them, and within 10 minutes they say, "Oh yeah, it's that guy," you know, who they've been they've sort of been getting on board for a while, and
asset. We don't even have to guess, because we can see what happened in Afghanistan in the 1980s.
Right.
You know,
that's the prime
example. We've seen this movie before.
We have.
And, and all these people we were arming Bin Laden. You know, he was our buddy because he fought Russians. And the Russians even said to us, "You know that this guy and people like him will eventually come for you." And we were like, we're the free people. They'd never come for us. But sure enough, they didn't think we were free. They thought we were corrupt, and they came for us. And that's right. You know,
David, you know,
Azov battalion.
Right. You said that
you don't like America.
I'll tell you one thing. The Nazis in Ukraine, they were recruited and run by the CIA, like even after, I think it started in 1948, if I'm not mistaken. And so when you say that they're going to get rid of them, I really don't know. I have very severe doubts, to put it mildly.
You know, it won't be popular for them to take over. So, I mean, just the CIA being the CIA, they will double cross them eventually when they've outlived their usefulness. they will double cross them, and of course they will come for the CIA. There's no, that's the problem when you've got people on your side who don't really have any values, don't really have any morals, who are basically criminals working for you. When you lie down with dogs, as they say, you get up with fleas, and these guys will eventually double cross each other and eventually start fighting each other, because they're not motivated by doing the right thing. They're motivated by some sort of weird violence and sort of short-term revenge. And they are not people who can be trusted in the long run. And they will eventually, the CIA don't play fair. I mean, they're eventually going to turn on each other, and it's going to be a sort of carnage. And it's a carnage created by very short-term thinking, where all they really care about is winning the next US election. and that is not a good way to try to run the world. And that's one of the problems with the Iraq war. You know, George Bush would have been thrown out in the 2004 election unless he'd gone to war. And that was probably the only reason they went. And it would have... the amount of million people dead, you know, 20, 30 million people displaced. And then, of course, you see it even in then, because then Syria was the same.
Yeah,
on one
hand,
they were starting a war in Syria. And on the other hand, they were outraged. There were all these Syrian refugees trying to get to Europe. And
Who created the refugees?
didn't connect the dots and say, this is what happens. This is a situation you created. And how dare you now sort of be outraged and sort of like say, no, stay in Syria. You know,
apparently they're the invaders. You know, not the CIA, not MI6, not the SAS, not the British Army, the Americans. No. It's a bunch of civilians. Refugees are the invaders.
They create these situations.
Upside down world.
Sort of short-term goal. And then they complain about the situation that they've created, and having to mop up, pretty much everything from Osama bin Laden to these sort of attacks in England after, when they were bombing ISIS. Everything is actually, you can draw back to US aggression in these foreign countries to begin with.
Yeah.
And it comes back to bite them eventually. It all starts with them overextending themselves and thinking that it's clever and giving money to dodgy people and doing terrible things. And then, of course, they get attacked. And then they blame the people that attacked them. But it's not that hard to trace the origins of attacks on America and attacks on Britain to attacks they have made on other countries without justification.
Look at Libya as well, by the way. The list is so long, you know, Somalia, etc.
Libya, they've turned it into a sort of prehistoric country with slave markets and they thought they were being clever, you know.
Yeah, but Gaddafi was more evil, so, you know.
Of course. That's right, and they get away with it. They simply cannot handle anyone who successfully has a different system to them, you know.
You know,
and this is, again, one of the sort of peace missions, I want to say. We need to be able to accept so hypocritical, you know. We do business with the Saudis, who are the most sort of repressive or hardline Islamic regime, and we don't do it. There's no problem with the Saudis. They even cut up Khashoggi and, you know, and tricked him and cut him up, and that we don't have a problem with that. But we cannot deal with the Taliban because of their hardline principles. I mean, the hypocrisy is disgusting. You know, it's really
chop up journalists, but no barrel bombs.
Yeah. exactly. I mean, we can't. And of course, they're setting themselves up for an Afghanistan Mark V, but by cutting off the Taliban from any foreign aid and for refusing to, you know, letting their children starve, etc.
Yeah, and then they say they're failed states. They're not failed states.
Make them a failed state, and they're going to have to seek money from somewhere. So where are they going to go? You know,
opium, probably. I don't know. Yeah, but the thing is, if you look at opium in Afghanistan, it skyrocketed after the invation.
One of the things that turned my blood was because I was there. I was one of the few people to be in Afghanistan in 2000 when the Taliban were running it, and the Taliban did destroy the, you know, they did destroy the opium, even though they could have made money over it, because Mullah Omar said. He thought about it and he said it's un-Islamic. It's going to cause Islamic people to die.
I see.
And he was the only one tough enough to actually put it through. And, of course, we denied that. We pretended that he wasn't in charge. We sort of said, oh, the Northern Alliance are the real government, even though that wasn't true on the ground. And then when we invaded, opium came back again. And yet we still managed to paint them as the bad guys, the opium dealers, whatever. But it was us. It was us, the opium dealers. And they had tried to, and we never gave them any credit. And also we saw in 2000, we saw the starving people, because they'd had some famines in 1998, 1999. We saw the Afghans, a lot of them were starving and their kids were dying of hunger. And we refused to give them any aid. This is one of the reasons why they blew up those Buddhas. You know, they were so outraged that they weren't going to blow the Buddhas up because they were hoping to get tourists coming to see them. But they were outraged that, I think it was the Japanese, said they would give them billions of dollars to fix the Buddhas, but they wouldn't give them a cent to feed their children, you know. And they just thought that was outrageous. They just thought we were the most disgusting sort of people, that we were happy to see their children die because they didn't enforce human rights. So we'll let them die. That's our punishment for them not, you know, living under Western standards. But we will give them money to fix statues, you know, because that's important to us, you know. You know, they don't need propaganda and brainwashing. All they needed was the truth, because it was pretty. It showed just how full of shit we were. You know, we didn't care about Afghans. We didn't care. We know plenty of famine doesn't discern between gender. Plenty of women died because they were starving, and girls, baby girls. We didn't care. We didn't care about that.
Where are their human rights?
Yeah, but we didn't like their human rights record, so we weren't going to give them food.
I'll never understand this logic of, you know, punish the entire civilian population because we don't like 10 people in a cabinet.
Oh, yeah. And yeah,
it's evil.
There's no sense in it. And the media need to get and kick up the button to start
reporting
on it. Because and hypocrisy to say.
This is why we need people like you, Dave.
And it doesn't even work, you know. You look what happened. We thought we were being clever with, you know, Afghanistan in the year 2000 and didn't give them any food or didn't give them any aid. And then next thing you know, you have 9/11 and you have 20 years of war. So it doesn't even work, you know. Hypocrisy and lies will only create more war. And it's hard not to agree with Julian Assange to say, they're not trying to end the wars. They just want endless war because endless war is profitable and turns public money into private money. And while if you said that to me 20 years ago, I would have said, well, that's a little bit extreme. I don't know that's true. But having seen what I've seen, I think that's actually true. And that's, you know, that's a disgrace. And the Nike company.
Why not?
All the corporations. Why not? They should be speaking up because that cannot be good for business. It might be good for business if you sell bombs, but there's a whole lot of businesses that don't really benefit from war. And those businesses should be speaking up and saying, look, why don't we concentrate on healthcare? Why don't we concentrate on lifting the Americans people out of poverty? And that might be a better thing to concentrate on war. Yes, McDonnell Douglas and Grumman and all these people, they might make less of a profit, but too bad, you know, because selling bombs, the problem is if bombs get dropped, they kill people and it creates death and sadness. And we've become that snake biting its own tail. Eventually, we will die.
Dave, you know, it's like you said before. Just by saying what you said, that you know, lift people out of poverty, give them health care. I don't know why this is radical, but just by saying these things, that makes you more of an American. So, you know, an American patriot, quote unquote, than like Pompeo. Easily.
Yeah, exactly. I care more about him.
It's true.
Because Twitter's quite, you know, you've only got so many characters on Twitter. You could have to say, you know, the US is bad, but I love the American people. I want to be able to.
Yeah, this is a deflection. This is you hate the West, you hate America. Or something. That's absolutely rubbish, rubbish, rubbish. The people who hate the West are the ones starting these wars. They take the money of everyone in the West and spend it on bombs to murder people and enrich themselves.
If we had an accurate movie about the U.S. at the moment, the villains would be the bad guys in the U.S. government. You know. That's why I can't handle anything.
They used to have Leslie Nielsen. I don't know if anyone will remember. He'll burst in, and then there's all you know. There's Khomeini and all the quote unquote evil leaders, you know, at a table. It's so comical. It's really comical.
I know, but it's really the bad guys of the world are in Washington D.C. You know,
unfortunately, and,
They're not patriots. They're there to make them, you know,
they're not.
Dick Cheney's, they're there to make themselves rich.
Yep.
And I'd happily go and work for Robert Kennedy Jr. for his campaign. Another one of my many dreams is helping him get elected. I've got a lot of American friends, and that's I'd love to go and help clean it up because it could be great. I'm not anti-American at all. I'm anti-crook. I'm anti-criminal. And we need to clean the place up. And I'm very excited by Robert Kennedy's platform. And I think, you know, calling the bullshit on the foreign wars and various other things.
I think
really good.
Yeah, I think that might be him. I saw one clip, and I'm not too familiar with him. I think that might be the one. I think it was about NATO. He was doing some conference or something. But I haven't watched all of it.
That we say. Yeah, he sort of says, yeah, look, we need to stop the foreign wars. We need to start telling the truth. We need to go to do healthcare. I mean, all sorts of stuff that if you had any kind of any sensible person would think is hardly radical.
It's good
to see that there are some people out there. Tulsi Gabbard's another one. She seems very sensible. She's someone that's actually been in the military. It shows you, you know, all the crappy, phony patriots like Pompeo. I mean, Tulsi Gabbard's actually been in the military. She's a major. She was a major like me. She's a mother. She's someone that actually has some credibility, has actually fought for her country, not like all these phonies in Washington. And, she's anti, you know, anti this ridiculous wars. Anyway, she's like me. She put on a uniform. So she's not anti-soldier, but she's anti-bullshit wars.
Yeah, but Dave, I'll tell you something, and I've said this before. You know, I don't necessarily agree with everything she says, but the stuff about the wars, she, you know, because she criticizes that, they were starting to call her like, I think it was Hillary Clinton saying she's like a Russian asset or something. She's a major. I think they would have known that whether she's a Russian asset or not by now. You know, the amount of background checks.
Exactly.
It's just lunacy. Like, what does this even mean?
Yeah. Well, I'm sure I'm a Russian. Well, I actually have been to Russia. I've been to Vladivostok when we were doing the documentaries. But yeah, I mean, I laugh because, I'm probably a Russian-Chinese asset. Anyone that criticizes them, I think that was one of the greatest tweets of all time, was that Tulsi Gabbard.
Oh, right. I remember now, the Queen of Warmongers. It was a legendary tweet. It was.
Hillary, she's such a hapless fool. She gets, I don't know, I think it's a parody account, but it's kind of real, where she's, the Taliban even burnt her. You know, they say, you know, you're just complete failure in everything you do.
I got to give her credit for that tweet. That was quite monumental. Queen of warmongers.
Pretty funny. And,
she definitely is.
You still see Hillary Clinton get wheeled out to comment on affairs. And I just, every time I see her now with a microphone in a pantsuit, I say, want to say,
oh my God,
what about your, the great Pied Piper plan?
Yes.
It turns out
she wanted
she
Trump.
Basically,
she
basically
wanted Trump.
Put Trump in the White House.
Yeah, she thought he's such an idiot that she's going to lose.
Talk about poetic justice.
Oh my God, they're both clowns if you ask me.
I know,
that was just poetic justice.
He's a clown, but
way.
It does make you laugh because that's your idea of strategy. It didn't work very well.
Wow. All of her politics.
My dog's getting a bit upset now. I might have to take him out for a walk. He's like,
you do that, Dave. Again, thank you so much for coming on. It's always a pleasure, and I'm going to plug your Twitter on the screen so people can find it. What's your handle again?
Murdoch Cadell.
Murdoch Cadell. Okay. Yeah. Give me a second.
But if you just put in Major David McBride, I think it comes up. But MurdochCadell. And there's a picture of me with my dog, I think.
There we go.
There he is.
That's the one.
That's the one, yeah.
All right, I'm zoomed all the way in there, and I've highlighted it there. You guys definitely go follow David McBride, and then, you know, I'm going to do everything I can to shine some light on your case and Julian's case, and anytime there's an update, please, you have an open invitation, Dave, so please come on whenever you feel like it.
I'm glad. I'm glad.
The podium is yours.
Radio show. We might have to have you on that one, though.
That would be very nice.
Quite well known out here now.
Oh, lovely.
And a lot of our little clips that we've done together, they get circulated. My Australian fans on Twitter have circulated our first interview, saying this is one of the best interviews that David's done because we have a chance to go in depth about
it. Yeah.
So it's good for
it
you.
Very nice.
Good for me. It gives you some audience out here.
True.
So,
again, thank you so much, Dave.
Will this be on a podcast where people can download?
Yes, it will. Yeah. If you type Richard Medhurst on whatever Apple Podcasts or Spotify, you'll find it. It's just type Richard Medhurst, and every single episode that I do is there, whether it's video or otherwise.
Yeah, well, you keep up the good work.
I will, and I appreciate you saying that. Thank you so much.
Okay.
All right.
I'll take
care, Dave.
For a walk, and yes. Lovely to talk to you.
Likewise.
Thanks for watching.